Reading is from Mark 12, verse 1 to 12, the parable of the tenants. Jesus then began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the wine press, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent still another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, "They will respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Haven't you read this passage of scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Then the chief of priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders looked for a way to arrest him, because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away.
Lord, may the words of my mouth and meditation of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Elaine and I agree about most things in life. That's the secret of success in marriage. But there are some things when it's otherwise. And here's one. She loves the TV program Death in Paradise. And I can't stand it. But we come to a compromise, and it is that we watch it. But my mind's somewhere else. But here's the thing about it. Elaine really should be in another role, and that is as a detective inspector in the police, in the CID. Because Death in Paradise is not 5 or 6 minutes into the program she knows she's done it. She's got a strong hunch, and almost always it turns out to be right. She says, "Look at that one, shifty looking eyes," or something like that, and she knows who has done it. She knows how it's going to end up. Some stories are like that. I suppose if you look to Elaine's own story, well, it's like that. She sort of saw what she wanted in early years. She wanted to be a school teacher, a primary teacher, and so it is. She's been doing that since she was finished college and still now. And I think if you'd asked her in earlier years about children, she would have said, "I want 3 children. She's got 3 children. And as early as primary 3, she knew she wanted me as her husband. She longed for this gorgeous boy and longed to spend her life with this wonderful man. And sure enough, it came out exactly as she hoped for and planned. And we have a letter that Elaine wrote, I think it was in primary 3. She's nodding her head. And it was a little letter to me saying that she loved me from primary 3. So there are some stories that from the beginning, you sort of see how it's going to work out. And in some details, at least, it has for her. I'm not meaning by that it hasn't for me. But there are other areas of my life which I could not have foreseen. I had no sense at all that I would be a minister. None at all. Come all through school and university, I left university, went to work, had no idea that God had plan and purpose for me in the ministry of his church. That was a surprise. I don't think I saw it coming, and maybe no one else either. But even after I had understood that God was calling me and had responded to his call to ministry, I had no idea I was coming to the east coast of Scotland. That was not in my plan. I'm a Glasgow boy through and through. And that's where I wanted to minister. But here we are. We've been on the east coast in our Arbroath there and now living in Carnoustie for more than half our lives. I never saw that coming. That wasn't on my wish list. But here we are. God had plans that we could not have foreseen at that point. I wonder when you consider your own life, if you would reckon that, yep, this is what I saw happening. This is what I dreamed about. Or if you would look back and say, no, it's taken all kinds of twists and turns that I did not see coming, and neither would I have wanted. Well, when it comes to the story of Jesus, then how it was going to work out was determined from the very beginning. There was never any doubt about it. Go to, for example, the Gospel of Luke, and right there in the second chapter, we read that his parents, Mary and Joseph, have brought him to the temple for the consecration that was required according to the Jewish law. And as a sacrifice, as part of that, they gave two doves and two pigeons, and then Jesus was lifted up and was dedicated or consecrated. Such was according to the law. But even then, while still he being an infant, there were two people there that day, Simeon the prophet and Anna the prophetess. And it was Simeon who spoke about Jesus, who prophesied over his life about who he would be and about what the effect of his life would be. And having said that, he then turned to Mary and told her that a sword will pierce your heart too. Even here at the very beginning of Jesus' life, an indication of how it was going to work out. And then, of course, at the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, we read about it in Matthew and Mark and Luke, that what he was doing and what he was saying was causing all kinds of antagonism and enmity from the religious leaders at the time. He had come to stir the pot, to change it up, to revive and to reform and to bring people back to God, and they didn't like it one bit. And we read very early in his ministry that they started to scheme and plot and plan against him. The outcome was already becoming clear. And then Jesus himself began to tell his followers that the Son of Man, in other words, himself, would be handed over to be crucified. This was one of these stories where the end was known from the beginning. There's no surprise factor that Jesus is handed over and crucified. That was coming. So it was a story that started in Bethlehem and raised in Nazareth and taken to the temple, and then through his ministry in Galilee. And it's a story that reached its high point when Jesus took his followers away on something that we might call a retreat. And while there, he asked them, who do people say that I am? What's the word on the street? You find this in Matthew 16 and replicated in the other Gospels. What's the word in the street? What are people saying about me? And his disciples say, well, some say that you're Elijah. Some say you're one of the prophets. Some say you're John the Baptist come back. And Jesus says, all very interesting, but who do you say I am? Who do you say that I am? Friends, that is the biggest, most important question that has ever been asked since the dawn of time. And it is still the biggest and most important question now. For every single people who walks this earth and for every single person who's gathered here this morning, the question that Jesus asks is, who do you say I am? And it was Peter, his follower Peter. It was always Peter. He was the one who always spoke up first. And he said, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now, in many ways, that's the high point, the zenith of the story of Jesus' life, because here you have this realization, this understanding that Jesus is more than another teacher, more than another prophet, that he is the Son of God. And how he must have rejoiced inwardly, seeing that now his folk understood it. They had been following him, listening to his teaching, seeing the miracles he performed, seeing the compassion he had for the poor and the needy, and now they got it. And there's the high point of the story. But from then onwards, it's all going towards the cross. In the 9th chapter of Luke, and at the 51st verse, it says this: from that point, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem and for what awaited him there. And so now, in the season of Lent, that's the journey that the church is on. We're all together heading now to Jerusalem and to Good Friday, when we will remember Jesus and his cross. How fitting then that that journey towards Jerusalem features Jesus telling this particular parable. A parable about the death of a son. A parable about the killing of a beloved son. Did you hear that in the text as Ruth read it for us? He only had one messenger left. It was his only son, his beloved son. At the very beginning, when the story started, the cross was just a distant dot on the horizon. But now, it's looming large over everything. And so for the church in Lent, we're drawing nearer to the cross. So the parable has an owner of the vineyard who digs trenches, who builds watchtowers, who plants, and so on. You know there are parables in the New Testament that require much thinking and have caused much controversy about what is meant here. Who do these people stand for? There's none of that here. There's not a Bible scholar on the face of the earth who has ever doubted the meaning of this parable. That the owner of the vineyard is none other than God himself. And that the vineyard stands for God's people. Now, it would have been obvious, therefore, to Jesus' hearers, because the language, this whole business about the vineyard and the owner of the vineyard, would have been words that were familiar to them. Go into their own scriptures at that time, and the prophet Isaiah in chapter 5, and we read this, "I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one," the Lord himself, "had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared its stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it," and so on and so on. Jesus, in other words, was taking the themes and the images for this parable straight from the scriptures of the Old Testament, as we call it, the Hebrew scriptures. So they knew. They knew as he unfolded this parable what he was saying. The owner of the vineyard is God himself, and the vineyard is them, his people. So he plants the vineyard, and then we're told the owner lets it out to a number of tenants who work the land. And then the time for the harvest comes. And the exact word used for this time of harvest, I love the phrase, "when the time was right." When the time was right. There's a phrase. You can Google it perhaps later on. Bible, "when the time was right." You'll find it recurring over and over. Paul's letter to the Galatians in chapter 4. "But when the time was right, God sent his son to buy freedom for us who were slaves." And 500 years before Paul's writing, also in the prophet Isaiah, "when the time is right, I, the Lord, will make it happen." When the time is right. Friends, cling on to this truth that God is in charge, and that God will do what God will do when the time is right, according to his goodwill and purpose. The problem is that's so hard to hang on to, especially in seasons like this when the world seems to be, in so many ways, just spinning out of control. And you wonder, with good reason, where's God in all of this? Where's God now? Why doesn't God act now? Remember these words. God acts when the time is right. That's true for worldly affairs, and it's true in our lives. When the time is right. And so it was in this parable. The harvest has come. The time is right. And so the owner of the vineyard sends his messenger for his rightful share, for the owner's rightful share of the produce of the vineyard. Notice he doesn't ask for it all, nor too much. He asks for his rightful share. But the servant is beaten and thrown out, and many others followed and suffered the same fate, actually with the violence increasing in turn. They were adamant that the owner of the vineyard was getting nothing from them. And then we come to this most important part of the parable. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. Go to the beginning of Matthew's gospel. You have the story of Jesus' baptism. He submitted himself to the baptism of John to be with us in that. And then as he came up out of the water, a dove descended upon him, and a voice from heaven came and said, "This is my beloved son, in whom I am pleased, the one I love." His only son. the one whom he loved, given for us. So in the parable, the son is killed and thrown out the vineyard. I see this as foreshadowing exactly what was to happen just a short time afterwards, as Jesus himself was taken out the city walls to the hill at Calvary and there crucified. This parable speaks of human nature. I want to read a passage from this book which I think sums it up absolutely perfectly. All of us, as human beings, are tenants of that vineyard. We know in our inmost hearts the humanity and goodness required of us, and yet, shimmering beneath the elements of the parable, there is a kingdom drama that continues in every time and in every place. The turning point of this drama is when the tenants of the vineyard mutter to one another, "This is his son. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." This is the oldest story in human history, as old as Adam and Eve, hiding from God in the garden. And it is the newest story, the latest breaking news of what's going on in the world right now. The endless quest to banish God, the living God, from the vineyard. And yet God keeps coming to us. The beloved Son keeps coming to us, coming in love and yearning for our love. Like the tenants in the parable, we are under the illusion too often that if only we can banish God, then we can live as we please. No troubling thoughts about carrying a cross or welcoming the stranger or embracing the outcast. None of that. Let's cast the Son, the beloved Son, out. And then we will be free to live our lives and make our choices and to live as the book of Judges says. In those days, there was no king of Israel, and all the people did what was right in their own eyes. Once we have cast God out of the vineyard, there is no more beloved Son, no more inconvenient will of God pressing in our lives. As author Richard Dawkins puts it in his book, The God Delusion, "I think God is very improbable, and I live my life on the assumption that he is not there." Isn't that the Scotland we're living in? Isn't that what has become of our land and of so much of the West? Who first heard about the beloved Son? From those apostles, from Paul, who would go to what we now call Turkey and into the Roman Empire. And wouldn't that word be passed to the saints before? Who came to these shores, to Ireland and to Scotland, Columba and Ninian and so many others, who brought with them the news of the beloved Son? And look now at this nation who gives never a thought to the beloved Son. we have cast him from the vineyard, have chosen to live our lives on our own terms. The parable describes life. And so in this Lenten season, there is one call upon us, and that is that in all of these days, our prayer be, Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy upon us. Say it with me. Lord, have mercy upon us. See, the danger is, we read a parable and we think it's talking about people a long time ago, and yes, it was, but this is like looking in the mirror. Because there's aspects of all of our lives which have involved throwing the servants and then the son from the vineyard. Lord, have mercy upon us. So be faithful through Lent in that prayer and in that calling, Lord, come again. Pray for this nation, that there may be a day you may see it, you may not, I may see it, I may not, when this nation once again will turn to the Lord and will hunger and thirst for God once more. I mentioned chapter 5 of the prophet Isaiah. This afternoon, set yourself one task, read the rest of that chapter. It talks about the vineyard, but it makes a promise that God is coming. And there's where our heart is, and there's where our hope is. So I don't have concluding words for this message today, but we have a concluding song to sing. And I'll invite the band to come back through us and lead us in it. As we sing together, there is a Redeemer, a Redeemer, Jesus, God's own Son.